Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Abu, and I'm an alcoholic. And tonight I'm a very grateful alcoholic because I didn't drink today. I'd also like to say happy Thanksgiving to everyone. For we indeed do have a lot to be thankful for. AA saved my life. Because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in a state of bemusement. Two biscuits short of a picnic. You know, not knowing whether I was fish or fowl, but it took coming into this room a day at a time and learning to know who and what I am and learning how to grow up. And I guess today the greatest gift that I have received from Alcoholics Anonymous in these last 25 years last 24 years that I've been in AA, but I have been around AA for about 30. See, being around it is one thing, being in it is another. Because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I would hear the old timers get up and speak, you know, I wanted to be an old timer right away. At my very first meeting, I remember this lady had 5 years and she was speaking and sharing her experience and strength and hope, and she was coming up on her 5th year anniversary. And that night I was sitting there planning mine. You see? But to go back a bit, I was born and raised in Virginia on a tobacco plantation. And I had an uncle who was a town drunk. And this man was a constant source of irritation and embarrassment to the family. When he would get locked up, the man who owned the tobacco plantation would bail him out. And he would work sometime for a year or two working off these fines. And this one particular, while he was working off these fines, he wasn't allowed to drink and he was not allowed to go into town. So he had worked off one of these fines. I must have been around about 9 years old. And so he took me into town with him, and he picked up the first drink. Now, it was the custom of the high sheriff to ride down the middle of the street at high noon every Saturday on his white horse. And my uncle picked up a drink of that corn whiskey. And see, when the sheriff came down the street, everybody got out of the way. Good evening, sheriff, and tip your hat and get down in the gutter someplace. You know, get out the sheriff's way. But my uncle had picked up that drink of alcohol, and he didn't do that. He walked up and slapped the sheriff's horse in the face. Now, this was down in Virginia in 1940 or something. That didn't set too well. Well, my uncle, needless to say, put him back in jail, but I was so embarrassed, I didn't know what to do. And, back in those days, you know, you took a bath once a week on the weekend, and you'd go in town on Saturday and shop and whatnot. So there were some church ladies from the neighborhood, so they took me back home. But I had promised myself, you know, that I would never, ever in life become like my uncle. Life didn't last long. When I turned 18 years old, I joined the Air Force. And I remember after basic training, we were allowed to go to the Airmen's Club and drink beer. And so I went with 4 or 5 other guys, and they ordered beer, and I ordered a Coke. And they said, if you're going to hang out with us, you've got to drink. And at that time, I weighed about 110 pounds, and I had a very high-pitched, squeaky voice. And I said, I don't drink. So they said, you're going to drink or wear it. So rather than to have them pour that beer on me, I drank it. It was the most horrible concoction I had ever tasted in my life. but after about 3 or 4 cups of that stuff, I felt a warmth, a glow, an ecstasy stole over my entire body. And in that moment, I knew the secret of life. This is how men and women became successful. They drank. And I commenced to drink. I became a daily drinker. But I always had this thing in the back of my mind. I didn't want to become like my uncle. So very early, I learned how to consume large amounts of alcohol and not stagger and fall down. I think I staggered and fell in the street one time during my 17 years of drinking. The rest of the time, I would drink in blackouts and just, you know, walk around. I would go to a party, and I'm dressed up, I'm clean. And when I came out of the party, I looked the same way. Everybody else was getting up all wrinkled. I would find me a place, you know, and get me somewhere and lay down like this. See? So when I get up, I wouldn't look like a drunk. I was a very miserable drunk. Anyway, I made sergeant, made airman of the month, and I'm drinking now, and I was stationed at Sampson Air Force Base that's in Geneva, New York at the time. And one day, you know how we do, you know, after a while you drink and you become discontented. Now, I went in the orderly room one day, and on the bulletin board was a notice, and it said, anyone want to volunteer for service? I think it was in Asia or in Labrador. And I went to Labrador. Way up there somewhere near Alaska up there someplace. And I was a cook while I was in the service, so when I had made sergeant, so the mess sergeant was there, it was time for him to come back to the States, so I became the mess sergeant, but much to my dismay, there was no alcohol in the place. So now, but I remedied that real quick, because I had access, you see, to all these peaches, pears, plums, and fruit cocktail, which I opened up and dumped into a vat, threw some yeast and sugar, and took it down in the boiler room and poured ginger ale in it. It was bubbling and carrying on in about a week. You see, and we drank. Now I stayed drunk. I had to drink. You know, I was able at this time to function. As a matter of fact, I would be on the job 2 and 3 hours early trying to prove that I wasn't drunk. I drank. It was against regulations to fraternize with the Eskimos. So myself and a couple other airmen who were out to lunch, we went down with the Eskimos, and you know the things that we told the people, we were doing things people never heard of before. So we got busted. And I was called into the commander's office, and he said, you know, you, I don't know what's wrong with you. So they sent me to the psychiatrist. They said, you're a good worker. You know, we like you. And so they sent me to the psychiatrist trying to find out what was wrong with me. Now, so this continued. So he called me back in one day, and see, when I drank, I went into a world of fantasy. And I had seen a British film where the commander called the sergeant into his office for some infraction, and the sergeant took off his gloves and he thwarted the commander across his face. See? So I did the same thing, you know? And the man sat there stunned. And so, and this was coupled with other things too, because already, you know, that happened, and I got away with that. But also when I drank, see, because at that time I was up in the closet, way up in the closet. But when I picked up a drink of alcohol, soon as when the alcohol went up to my lips, my hand went up between your legs, you know. And so, so I had groped one too many people, and they found that out. So, you know, they told me take a walk, you know. I got a undesirable discharge, but I had, when they put me out, I volunteered for 4 years. I had about 3 years and 2 months. I had about 2 months to do. And I had saved some money, so I tore the discharge up. Went home, because what disturbed me, you know, what kind of job would I be able to get? And I had to figure out a way to, you know, to make some money. Because I was also, I was the type of drunk. I didn't drink. I stopped drinking if I didn't have a job. I had to have a job. So, you know, I have, when I came in there, I had a job. I have never drank wine or slept in a park or been on welfare and SSI. That's still some of my yes. It haven't happened to me yet. But anyway, while I was waiting to be shipped back to the States, I was reading this magazine. And in the back of the, it is one of these magazines, you know, in the back there's all these ads of how you can become a preacher overnight and how you can become, get a PhD without going to school and, you know, stuff like that. And there was this one big ad that said, do you want to get rich? And I definitely did want to be rich. They said, if you want to be rich, grow mushrooms. So this is what I went back home to Virginia. And back in those days, black people didn't eat no mushrooms. They called them frog stews. And, I went back home and announced that I was going to grow mushrooms. See? So one morning I heard my, you know, I got up half drunk and I heard, you know, my cousin, she was saying, you know, when he went away from me, he was all right. You know? But they said, and then my uncle said, well, maybe the boy's shell-shocked, you know? And I hadn't been near the battlefield. But anyway, you know, I went to the bank. The man that owned the bank also, owned the plantation that we lived on and owned most of the town. So I went in the bank to get my money. He said, boy, leave your money in the bank. He said, we need hands down on the farm. And I had this long cigar in my mouth and I blew smoke in his direction. I said, I'm going into mushrooms. Man looked at me like I didn't have good sense. But anyway, I went into the farmer's supply store and bought the farm, bought the outfit, bought the farmer's get up. I went into the men's clothing store and bought myself a white Palm Beach suit. I went into the liquor store and bought a case of Top Chef booze. Went home and, my cousin, she had this little small farm and I gave her a few $100 to grow this, to use this farm to grow these mushrooms on. And me and this case of liquor. Every morning I would get up and I'd put on this farmer's get up and I would go out on the porch fanning in the southern heat and surveying the vast acreage. And I'm saying to myself, all of this is mine at such an early age. And I began to fantasize in my mind of the money that I was going to make off of these mushrooms. Well, anyway, I had sent off $400 and some to buy this stuff, whatever it was one needed to grow the mushrooms, right? But I'm drinking every day. You know, in the morning it was gin and tonic. In the afternoon it was something else and something else. I drank all day long. And then, you know, and standing out in 100-degree heat, you know, out in the field where these mushrooms are supposed to grow. Well, no, so one day something told me you better open up the box and see how to grow these things to get them in the ground. I opened up the box and there were these long instructions. You had to, the things had to grow in a temperature control. You had to build this apparatus. And I had no money to build nothing like that. So now I looked out in the field and something said, go crumble this stuff up. Throw it out in the field so God would send the rains and the mushrooms would come up. Well, I threw them out there and I said, you know, I was discharged in April, May, June, July, August, September come. My money was almost gone. No mushrooms has grown to this day. People was laughing at me, you know, called me the mushroom man. Well, an alcoholic will always figure a way to get a drink. And if you are an alcoholic, it is impossible for you to do anything right or wrong. You know how many times, you know, we get drunk and we come to ourselves, let me get myself together and go get a job. That would be the right thing to do. But we get up and stop in the bar and pick up the first drink and you never get where you're going. Maybe that you decide to do something wrong, to rob the bank, right? But you stop by the bar and you pick up the first drink. And you done told everybody, I'm going to rob the bank. You know, and the police, I mean, it's crazy. You can't do nothing, right? But anyway, in that same book where I found the mushrooms, there was a place called a Black Arts Club where you could become a witch doctor in 3 years or less. Now, people down south were superstitious, so I figured, you know, this is a good way to make some money. I got my old drunk wine old cousin, and I said, look, you put the spells on the people, I'll take them all. And you know, when I'm drinking that corn whiskey, I would go down on the weekends, you know, they had these called, these liquor joints way down in the bushes. And even the sheriff didn't go down. The only reason time he would go down there, if somebody got to done shot somebody down there, he'd go down there and drag them up out of there. That's the only time he went in there. So anyway, I would go in these places, you know, and, the word had gotten around, you know, that he's practicing black magic. And people see me coming, they would get buy me a drink to get away from me. That's what I wanted anyway. So, but after a while, you know, people, it dawned on people, he can't put no spell on nobody. So my drink stopped coming. So one night I walked in the place, and there was like a long table, and there was a 300-pound lady sitting back there frying fish and dispensing the corn whiskey. And this man came in, he's about 6 foot tall, weighed about 200 pounds. The man had just come out of the field working a hard day, so he ordered himself a mayonnaise jar of corn whiskey. The man standing there minding his business, and I walked up to him, and I said, "I'm Dr. Clark, my throat's dry, I said, buy me a drink." He said, "Mister, you better get away from me." I said, "You don't know who I am." Woo! The man looked at me. He picked up his mayonnaise jar and downed it, and he set his glass down, and he grabbed me up in my chest and drew me to him and hauled off and slapped me all the way across the floor. He said, "Now, woo-woo that." You know? That was the end of my witch doctor's career. I left Virginia in embarrassment. I, went to Washington, D.C., from Washington, D.C., stopped in Philly, from Philly to New Jersey, and then here in 1959, here to New York City, and this is where my madness crystallized. I had worked at the seashore that summer. I had some money. Like I'm saying, if I didn't have a job, I would slow my drinking down or stop until I had a job and had some money coming in. I found a place to stay on 150th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue. On 149th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue at that time, there was a bar called the Red Rooster, where all of the pimps and the prostitutes and the people with the big money and the gangsters from Brooklyn would come over. And I went down the place, and I would go in there every night, and I would stand in the exact same spot and consume a half a fifth of Bacardi rum, because I remember something from that witchcraft book. It said, if you want to get people's attention, be mysterious. Be quiet. Be aloof. So I'm standing, and the people was watching me, you know. So on about Thursday night, the lady that owned the bar, she came over and she introduced herself. She said, "You're such a fine gentleman." She said, "You come in, you drink, you don't bother nobody." But while I'm standing there drinking, I noticed in the back there was a kitchen. Now, people was getting up out of the bar, going down the street to get food and bring in. So since I'm a cook, if I got this food concession here, and with the kind of clientele that come in this place, I could make a fortune. So I told the lady what I had in mind. She said, "Well, you're welcome to it." But I also had told her, you know, that I'm an international culinary. And I said, you know, I was trained in Switzerland, in Europe. She said, "Well, a person with your talent, it seemed like to me you would try the Waldorf or the Carlisle." I said, "No, I want my people to have the benefit of my talent. My people was anybody to drink." See? And these people drink alcohol. And so anyway, make a long story short, I set up, I got the place, and I was all prepared for my grand opening. And I remember that night I'm standing there, and it was the night before. I had my white outfit together with the white gloves and the white hat and the sword. That I was going to put this shish kebab on. See, when I come out the kitchen, it would be on fire. But I'm sitting there now. I'm drinking a concoction of five different liquors out of a coconut. And after about four or five of them things, it dawned on me, you know that now, Abu is my professional name. At that time, my legal name is Leon. So, but Leon, that is not a name for an international culinarian. So I took another sip of this stuff, and then it dawned on me, Chef Lou en Duplay. So that's what I became, you know? So the night of my grand opening, the music was right, the mood was right, the place was full of people, and I came out of the kitchen with this shish kebab, and the fire was going up in the ceiling. I had become so obsessed with alcohol. Everything that I served, if you ordered a hamburger, it was on fire. Scrambled eggs was on fire. Everything was on fire. Wasn't long before they told me to take a walk from out of there. Next job, few more jobs in between. A friend of mine was working for a private family in Midtown, and he knew this wealthy gay couple who needed a cook and housekeeper. So I went and I got the job, and I noticed one of the men never drank. Like I said, they were wealthy. They entertained people who drank, and some didn't. But I could never understand these people that would come to dinner from time to time, and I had to make up all of this coffee. Now, these people had a walk-in bar and had, you know, everything that you could think of. And it wasn't but a matter of time before the alcohol started disappearing. You know, I would drink up all the bourbon or whatever, then, you know, put tea or something in the bottle to try to replace it on payday. Guests would come to give me a scotch on the rocks, and I'd put, for them going in a blackout, pour this tea up on top of the rocks and give them, you know. My employer was constantly being embarrassed, and he would speak to me from time to time. He said, I think you have a drinking problem. But to make a long story short, one morning, I went in. He said, you got to do something about your drinking. He said, please don't drink today. He said, I'm having a very important business meeting here tonight. I promised him that I wouldn't drink, but the obsession was so great I couldn't help myself. But I was able to drink, like I'm saying, and move around, and I had the food all laid out. Everything was marinating in booze. Everything I cooked, the peas was cooked in booze that night. The dessert was marinating in booze. So it was about 12 or 15 of those people who didn't drink. He says, no, we don't have to serve no cocktails tonight. Make up plenty of coffee. These people came in, and went to the table, and I served this boozed up food, and they didn't eat it. And so I figured they must have eaten too many hors d'oeuvres. I can say, well, you know, maybe they'll be ready for the bananas flambé, which had been marinating in God only knows what. I put it on the stove, lit it, struck a match to it, and went to the table. They didn't eat that. I went into a blackout. I came into work the next morning. He said, don't change your clothes. He said, if you don't do something about your drinking, we're going to have to let you go. And I was terror-stricken. My life flashed before my face. I said, I'll go to AA. He said, good. Now, prior to this, he had given me the big book. And he had given me the book, The ABCs of Alcoholism by Marty, first woman to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had read, this was nice stories, you know, but I didn't see where it pertained to me. But anyway, I blurted out that I will go to AA. He said, good. He said, I was wondering when you'd get around to it. He said, I've been in AA for 21 years. And the reason people didn't eat that food that night, because it was the committee that meets every year to plan Bill W.'s annual dinner. And my employer were good friends with Bill and Lois. And through him, I met Bill W. And his wife on three different occasions. I also met Abby, who brought the message to Bill. And with all of this, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I'm saying, I had a job. I knew that the psychiatrist, and because he didn't tell me too much about it, he said, go to AA and you will see. But I thought the doctors and the psychiatrists would call me up to tell me to tell all these unfortunate people how you look so good and how you were able to keep a job and drink and still look the way you do. And that's where, and the night that I heard the lady who was coming up on 5 years, I sat there, I'm planning my 50th anniversary. They said, get the literature. I got all the literature. I bought the books. And like I'm saying, you know, I've lived in a world of fantasy. I stopped drinking right away. And just like an actor who picked up a script, that's how I practiced at Alcoholics Anonymous. You said to come early and stay late. That's what I done. You said set up front. That's what I done. You said move the chairs. That's what I done. Although I didn't smoke, I rattled the ashtrays and stuff around. This is what you said do. Because I'm sitting there, I'm waiting, and I'm practicing after my 90 days so that I'd be able to get up and give my talk. And I never will forget it. I gave a Broadway performance that night. I had memorized AA in the higher power. I had memorized the how it works, and I was ready. I walked the floor that night with the big book open, and I wept, and I talked about the grace of God and how I had been restored to sanity. And I told those people in there that night, I don't understand it. How y'all can be in here 5, 10, and 15, and 20 years and still working the steps. I said, I know the steps backwards and forwards. And I ran them down to them. I ran the steps from 1 to 12. And then when I got to 12, 11, and 12 and started talking about God, that's why I wept on cue. There were those in the room. Some people were sitting on the edge of their seat. But there were those sitting back like this, going like this. They said, keep coming. I thought it was a compliment. You know, you're in the right place. I'm saying to myself, why do they keep telling me that? I know that. Old timers was telling the newcomers, get away from that man. He's around AA, but he's not in it. But you see, I didn't, you know, if you weren't really on the ball, that's why they tell us in here, stick with the winners. I appeared to be a winner. I didn't act crazy. I didn't always have my mouth running. I was very quiet. Do what I was told to do. But underneath crazy as a bed bug, because all of the stuff that I would get up and mouth, you see, I couldn't practice none of it once I left outside of the meeting. Today I know, you know, and I got caught up into the thing. I would go all over the place, you know, because I was speaking all over the place. Of course, I wouldn't speak no beginner's meeting, didn't go to them, didn't need them, because, you see, was nothing wrong with me. And I had told myself that for so long doing my drinking, I actually believed it. It was years I was in here before I actually start feeling anything. Anyway, like I'm saying, you got to be in this fellowship. Being around it is not going to help you. Being a good public speaker will not save you, and I learned that the hard way. Because, you know, you couldn't tell me that I wasn't Mr. AA, and I didn't speak. You come ask me to speak, and it's a meeting with, you said, well, we got 15, 20 members. I was going to find a way to call you because I wasn't coming. The multitudes I like here tonight, so I could walk the stage, you see. But I long since I stopped doing that. I stopped doing that because it wasn't good for me. Anyway, like I'm saying, I came into AA. To make a long story short, y'all can take this any way you want it. I became a drug addict, sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous every day. Now you figure that one out. So tonight, I know that I'm in the right place. They were saying the Lord's Prayer, and I was coming out of a nod, and people looked at me. Crazy. My sponsor later told me, you come in the light and going blind. Because when they told me there is no substitute for alcohol, because I figured there had to be a way. There had to be a way, and one night I heard it. Like I'm saying again, they tell us we've got to stick with the winners. You got to be very careful what you listen to. Because I also heard around AA, this is a place where sick people are getting better a day at a time. There was this man, had about 10 years. I went into a closed meeting by mistake because I didn't go to them. Didn't need them. Was nothing wrong with me. But I went in one night by mistake. I got up off the front and went in the back. They had an argument back and forth what AA was for. Some says for your drinking, some says for your thinking. The man sitting next to me, he raised his hand. He said, I've been in here 10 years. He said, I don't drink. And then he whispered on his breath. He said, these people are crazy. He said, I smoked a little cocaine. I snort a little cocaine, smoked a little herb. I said, I want to speak to you after the meeting. I got up out of the meeting that night, and the rest is history. Well, I went back out. It was very brief. 1969, I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been here ever since. But I had to get busy. I had to get a sponsor. I had my sponsor told me to sit down, and in those days, he said, if I see you with your hand up in your air, he said, I'm going to beat your ass. I said, now listen. After a while, I began to hear. I began to learn the importance in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a whole lot of rhetoric in a lot of groups, a lot of rhetoric. I never heard so many new, nonsensical slogans in all the days of my life. You don't need no more slogans. The slogans are already here. Those slogans that we say in the meeting, they're already here. You know, there's no verse in the hearse. What kind of shit is that? It don't do you no good. It's cute. It doesn't save you. It doesn't do anything. Over the years, I have kept it simple. Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me to do the things that I used to sit in the bar and dream about doing. I always dreamt about being an actor, being on stage. I've done that. Before Martin Lawrence got his show, I was the opening act for him at the Apollo Theater. I've traveled. I've done comedy. I've been on television. I've done radio. I have done these things, and I not once have anybody ever heard me say, well, oh, I don't have time now to go to those meetings. If I'm traveling wherever I am, there is AA meetings all over the world. I make a meeting. It is, for me, as simple as that. By coming in here and being able, I got into show business, I got late. I was about 15, 16 years sober before it happened. But when it did, I was well grounded. I'd go in a club, do a show, get my money, and I'm gone. I've never had no problem. You see, because today I don't want to drink. In these last couple years has been, it's been both. You know, when you learn the joy of living, and to me, the joy of living is not how good things are necessarily, but it's how I handle those difficulties. In the last year, I've had 3 sponsees to die. The people that I used to work for, one died in 86. He died from AIDS. I was on the road doing, I'm also a painter. So I was on doing a series of exhibitions. So I got a call and he said, would you come back? So I went back. And I stayed there until he passed away. The last one, in 89, he came down with Lou Gehrig's disease. And he got a call, so he said, would you come back? Because I don't trust anybody but you. And he was 72 years old, and most of all of his family had passed on. He had living help, and they were abusing him and whatever. I went back. I cleaned them all out, got good nurses. We had nurses around the clock. And I would go in every day, 7 days a week. And he passed away in January. And like I'm saying, they were very wealthy people. And he left me most of his estate. So this year I've had good things happen. I've had things one would consider that's not so good. A few weeks ago, I had a slight heart attack. But I'm here tonight. As long as I can move, as long as I can breathe, you see, I make a meeting. For me, it is as simple as that. There were many places that I could go tonight, but there is no place any more important for me to be than here. Because you see, everything that I have gained is here. And you know what? It's not important how much money that I was left or have. It is something else. It's, you know, people ask me, they said, well, now you're going to buy a house or you're going to do this. I'm not going to do nothing. I don't have to do nothing. I have everything I need today. I have AA, and I have you. No amount of money can bring me happiness. No amount of lovers can bring me happiness, and y'all know they don't necessarily bring you happiness, and I will catch hell. I've caught hell with them people. But you know what? I was able to stick with them. And because today I'm able to understand myself, I was able to understand that they didn't understand. And that's the difference for me. So if you are new, keep coming. AA works. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.